Chapter 10. The Ever-Turning Sword. And he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims, and a flaming sword which turned every way, to keep the way of the tree of life. Genesis, chapter 3, verse 24. In his earliest secret notes, Darwin wonders if the lines of life in the Galapagos might have diverged simply by adapting to the strange new place in which they had alighted. They might have speciated simply by virtue of their isolation, as they altered further and further over time. In those first notes, Darwin imagines that enough small changes accumulating over enough geological time would be able to accomplish almost anything. Darwin implies as much in a famous scribble he made soon after the meeting with Gould over Darwin's finches. "Let a pair be introduced and increase slowly, from many enemies, so as often to intermarry. Who will dare say what result?" According to this view, animals on separate islands ought to become different if kept long enough apart, with slightly different circumstances. Now Galapagos tortoises, mockingbirds, Falkland fox, Chilo fox, English and Irish hare. Without question, this process of adaptation can and does go on. This is the process the Grants have documented in such detail in Darwin's Islands. The adjustments they saw the birds make after the drought and the flood are the kinds of changes the finches' ancestors would have made when they landed in these islands for the first time. Each year, Daphne is a new island, and its finches adapt to it from generation to generation. The work that began when their ancestors first landed on the island is never finished. But Darwin's finches are not marooned. Each species to its own island. On average, there are 7 or 8 species to each island in the archipelago. Beyond that, there is the constant traffic of visiting finches. The birds may have diverged, or have begun to diverge, in isolation, but they are not in isolation now. What happens when lines of life that have begun to diverge in isolation meet up again? Darwin has an answer, and it is one of the most original steps in his argument. "I can remember the very spot in the road, whilst in my carriage, when to my joy the solution occurred to me," Darwin recalls in his memoirs, "and this was long after I came to Down." By then, more than 10 years had passed since Darwin had seen the Galapagos. He had already written out a very brief abstract of his secret theory, 35 pages in pencil. He had expanded this abstract into a longer sketch of 230 pages and copied out the whole draft in a fair hand. He had kicked innumerable flints. Yet it was not until that moment, riding on the road, that Darwin felt he really understood the branching of the tree of life. What drives the branches to diverge again and again? How, then, does the lesser difference between varieties become augmented into the greater difference between species? Suddenly, Darwin perceived that adaptation to isolated specks of land is not the whole answer. He saw a way that natural selection acting on local varieties, species in the process of formation, in Darwin's view, incipient species, would drive wedges between these varieties and push them apart everywhere on Earth. For Darwin, it was like the Eureka in the legend, when Columbus peers at a butterfly perched on an egg, imagines the Earth in the palm of his hand, and suddenly perceives the obvious. It was as if Darwin had taken a few giant mental steps back and, craning his head, stared up for the first time at the whole tree of life. His vision had nothing to do with star-crossed lovers and the meetings and matings of hybrids. It was more like a vision of war. What Darwin realized is that two varieties living side by side are thrown into competition. Competition in a very large sense. like the contest the Grants are now watching among ground finches on Daphne Major. Individuals in each of two neighboring varieties will usually find themselves going after the same thing as their neighbors, precisely by virtue of their similarities, like two big-beaked ground finches hunting for the same tribulus seed. In the struggle for existence, one variety or species must often squeeze another. Nearest neighbors, closest cousins, will pinch each other very hard generation after generation. They collide because they are so much alike in equipment, instincts, and needs. Again, like finches scrabbling through the cinders of Daphne Major for the last tribulus seed, the more alike the varieties, the more frequently they will find themselves going for the same seed, the same nook, the same niche, at the same time. Competition through kinship. An exceptional individual will benefit under these conditions. Any escape, however partial, from that oppressive competition will be an enormous release, almost like finding a fresh island. The lucky individual that finds a different seed or nook or niche will fly up and out from beneath the Sisyphean rock of competition. It will tend to flourish, and so will its descendants. That is, those that inherit the lucky character that had set it a little apart. Individuals that diverge from the madding crowd will tend to prosper, while the rest will be ground down. Selection will act in this way on all neighboring varieties, not just on islands, but everywhere on the planet, and the effect will be continually to move varieties apart and repel them. Even if they never actually jostle and joust, never once collide physically over a tribulus seed or a nesting site in a crook of cactus, natural selection will gradually magnify their differences. At last, the two varieties will move so far apart that competition will slack off. It will slack off when the two varieties have evolved in new directions, when they have diverged. Natural selection will have led, in effect, to another adaptation, the mutual adaptation of two neighbors to the pressures of each other's existence. And the result of this sort of adaptation would be forks in the road, parting of the ways, new branches on the tree of life, the pattern now known as adaptive radiation. In Darwin's view, then, each line of life is forever reaching for its spot of sun. Competition among slightly divergent forms everywhere on the planet leads continually to new branches, radiating outward in all directions like a compass rose or the arms of a medieval sun. Darwin called this his principle of divergence. Again, Darwin never actually saw it happen, though he argued that it could happen, had to happen, and had happened. He pointed to his pigeons. Pigeon fanciers enjoy novelty, and they often cultivate the extremes. With tumbler pigeons, breeders had spent several centuries choosing and breeding from birds with longer and longer beaks, or with shorter and shorter beaks, Darwin notes in The Origin. As a result, the breeders had created two sub-breeds out of one, a long-beaked and a short-beaked tumbler. In Darwin's view, natural selection, too, would tend to make nature more and more diversified. Here the motor is not whim, taste, or love of novelty, as with the pigeon fanciers, but something more basic. The great thing is efficiency, or what the economists of Darwin's day were already calling the division of labor. It is obvious, Darwin writes in Natural Selection, that more descendants from a carnivorous animal could be supported in any country, if some were adapted to hunt small prey and others large prey. Likewise with herbivores. More could be supported if some were adapted to feed on tender grass and others on leaves of trees and others on bark, roots, hard seeds, or fruit. In other words, as varieties and species ramify, they will become better and better consumers of the world around them, like Jack Spratt and his wife, who between them licked the platter clean. The advantage of divergence is, in fact, the same as that of the physiological division of labor in the organs of the same individual body, Darwin writes in The Origin. There are certain relatively simple animals in which the stomach ingests both food and air and carries out both digestion and respiration. But a stomach specializing in digestion and a pair of lungs specializing in respiration can each do better work. No wonder Darwin remembered the exact spot in the road for the rest of his life. It is an extraordinary vision. Natural selection literally organizes life. The process of evolution by natural selection works right up the tree, from individuals to varieties, varieties to species, onward and upward, branching and branching, always diverging, helping to create all the myriad life forms on the planet. Whole lines die out as inevitably as individuals die out, but the result is always something new and alive. The tree grows. In this view, natural selection is even more powerful than Darwin first imagined. It is both beautiful and terrible, an agent of creation and destruction, like the flaming sword at the gates of Eden, which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. Darwin's principle of divergence has fascinated generations of biologists. But the process is not easy to observe and measure in action because it erases its own traces. In fact, Darwin's thesis predicts the general absence of competition. In his view, competition drives neighbors far enough apart that they are no longer locking horns or locking beaks. The Grants, for instance, can see that Fortis and Magnerostris on Daphne Major are competing for tribulus seeds. But how can they measure competition among the species that are no longer competing, like the cactus finches and the fuliginosa? If the finch unit finds the 6 species of ground finches living more or less harmoniously now, how do they know it was competition that drove them into relative harmony? Was the agent Darwin's principle of divergence? Where can they catch the gleam of the ever-turning sword? Again, this is one of the most contested questions in all of Darwin's theory, and Darwin's finches have been at the center of the controversy ever since David Lack published Darwin's Finches in the middle of the last century. The book created so much excitement because Lack announced that the beaks of the finches were in fact produced by Darwin's principle of divergence. All of the low-lying islands in the archipelago, for example, have either the small ground finch or the sharp-beaked ground finch, either fuliginosa or difficilis. The low islands never have both. The taller islands in the archipelago do hold both species, and there the two species keep more or less apart. Fuliginosa tends to gather around the base of the island, difficilis near the top. In his mind's eye, Lack saw this pattern as the aftermath of a great war across the whole archipelago, a war without generals or bloodshed, between the sharp beaks and the small beaks. Apparently, Lack said, these two species are so alike that whenever they breed side by side on the same island, they are thrown into competition. If the island has only one niche for them, then either the line of the sharp beaks or the line of the small beaks is driven to extinction. One species outcompetes the other. The technical term for this outcome of a battle between two groups of living things is competitive exclusion. But if the island is tall enough to offer one species a new niche, a path out of the race, that species can evolve its way out of the competition. Then it changes in character. The beak bends, melts, morphs, changes shape. Through evolution by natural selection, until that lineage of birds is freed from the dreadful war. The technical term for this outcome is character displacement. Lack pointed out that on Santa Cruz, the small beaks are small and the medium beaks are medium. On Daphne, where there are very few small beaks, the medium beaks have become smaller. On Los Hermanos, where there are very few medium beaks, the small beaks have become larger. Lack saw this same pattern with many other pairs of finches in the islands, again and again traces of character displacement. In the 1950s and 1960s, Lack and others explored competition theory and its ramifications. They pursued the theory so triumphantly and unanimously that a few ecologists and evolutionists with other interests began to feel competitively excluded. One of them was an American ornithologist, Robert Bowman, who went to the Galapagos in 1952 after Lack and studied the Galapagos finches as his thesis project. This was before the invention of mist nets. To find out what the finches were eating, Bowman shot them by the hundreds and inspected the contents of their stomachs. He decided that what a Galapagos finch eats does depend on its beak, a conclusion that would later be confirmed and extended in such extraordinary detail by the Grants International Finch Investigation Unit. However, Bowman also noticed, more than Darwin or Lack had noticed before him, that Galapagos plants, like Galapagos finches, vary from island to island. Bowman wondered if this variation in itself might explain the branching of the finches' lines. The birds might have evolved their distinctive beaks and habits by adapting to the local varieties of flowers and seeds as they settled on island after island. They might have speciated, in other words, according to Darwin's first vision of the evolutionary process, before his Eureka in the carriage. That was a simpler story, Bowman argued, and who could prove it wrong? Time and again, Bowman watched the sort of mixed flocks that Darwin himself had noted when he first got off the Beagle. Time and again he saw four or more species of ground finches feeding in the very same bush, small peaceable kingdoms of ground finches. And since there is no direct evidence that competition is occurring at the present time, Bowman declared in his thesis, I see no logical reason to assume that it must have occurred in the past. To argue that the absence of competition is a proof of its power seemed to Bowman infuriatingly circular reasoning. There were other ecologists who agreed with him. A pitched battle began between the competitive camp and the non-competitive camp, and in the absence of hard evidence and actual observations, it dragged on and on. The ecologist Joseph Connell declared in a celebrated manifesto that until someone came along with harder facts, he would no longer buy the old guard's arguments for Darwin's principle of divergence. I will no longer be persuaded by such invoking of the ghost of the competition past. The ecologist, Daniel Simberloff, was even more emphatic. He argued that Lack's famous patterns might be nothing more than the faces we see in the moon, in clouds, in Rorschach inkblots. Even if we see species living together in different niches, that does not prove that they drove each other into those niches, that they repelled each other like the identical poles of two magnets. They might instead have diverged by random adaptations toward different seeds and different needs. Finches colonizing the island at random would have produced patterns that could be interpreted in all kinds of ways. The finches' distributions in the archipelago might be most fruitfully treated as a random process. Peter Grant suspected that Lack was right. But he too was annoyed by Lack's dogmatic style, his willingness to issue pronouncements without having seen what is actually going on. Grant once accused Lack in print of a distressing lack of objectivity. Future generations, he wrote, will surely wonder that we discuss competition so much, yet know it so little and measure it even less. That was one of the fascinations of the events the Grants witnessed in their first dry season, events they still see repeated each year. Again and again, when the rains end, their flocks of Darwin's finches move apart and specialize, Magnirostris going this way, Fortis that way, Scandens and Fuliginosa going off on their own as well, each according to its beak. Not only does this divergence help to prove that the beaks of the finches are adaptive, it also helps to prove that their differences have survival value. It suggests that the forces Darwin envisioned in his carriage more than a century ago are at work right now among his finches. When birds that have been eating the same foods for months begin to fan out into specialties, according to the sizes and shapes of their beaks, we are seeing a kind of divergence in the course of a single season. And we can also see that the consequence is just what Darwin imagined. For as each dry season wears on and the birds are scrabbling for food, their choices as they hunt and peck diverge more and more, which reduces the competition between them. That they respond to the drought in this way, in effect making room for one another, may help to explain why they are able to coexist on the little island at all. Of course, in the dry season, the birds are only changing their behavior, not their beaks. Their diets diverge as their stocks of food are depleted, because so many individual birds stop trying to do everything and concentrate on what they do best, according to the beaks and bodies they were born with. Changing your behavior is much quicker than changing your anatomy. But the change is driven by the same sort of competition. Darwin's finches are responding to the same forces that Darwin believed led to their creation. The traditional picture of the economy of nature, the picture that most of us learned in school, is that nature is a stiff hierarchy, a food pyramid of more or less rigid trophic levels. Plants are at the bottom of the pyramid, making food from sunlight. Herbivores feed on the plants, and carnivores feed on the herbivores. Within each level, there are assorted specialists called guilds. Any ecologist can rattle off long lists of them. Leaf eaters, stem borers, root chewers, nectar sippers, bud nippers. Much like the feudal guilds of shoemakers, tailors, butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers. As more and more ecologists and evolutionists watch life up close and long term, the way the Grants are observing Daphne Major, they see that these categories are not as fixed as they had imagined. More and more naturalists are shifting their efforts from the study of pattern and structure to the study of process and motion, watching change through time and, like the finch unit in the Galapagos, what they see again and again is the lesson of Heraclitus. Everything flows. Nature is fluid. The finches on Daphne start out their year in a single guild, the guild of the ground finches. Then, in hard times, they break up into smaller guilds. Other ecologists and evolutionists are watching this same process of splitting and shifting guilds elsewhere. This fluidity of nature suggests that, as divergent pressures are repeated year after year, animals and plants around the world are even now evolving differences in physique and taste that, if they continue, will make their guilds diverge farther and farther. Of all the watchers who have worked with the Grants in the Galapagos, the one who has grown most fascinated with Darwinian divergence is Dolph Schluter. Schluter is a rising star now in the field of evolutionary biology, but he was about to drop out of school when he met the Grants. He had just completed an undergraduate degree in wildlife management at the University of Guelph in Canada. He hadn't applied to graduate school, even though he had the highest marks in his class. He was sick of school, burned out. He was planning to take a job trapping muskrat and mink in the Athabasca tar sands in Alberta. Then he heard a student of the Grants give a seminar. "I'd never realized people did this work," Dolph says now. "I knew about evolution, of course, but it had never struck me that someone could actually study it in modern times. My idea somehow was poring through fossils. That someone could watch evolution, it was a revelation. I wrote to Peter Grant. It was the only place I applied. Otherwise, I'd still be trapping muskrats." Dolph's PhD project under Peter Grant was a close-up study of the war between the small beaks and the sharp beaks on a single Galapagos island. Dolph read the latest manifestos of Simberloff et al., which called finch distributions a random process, and he went down to the islands in a state of radical doubt. "I was quite dizzy with the idea that everyone, including Grant, had overestimated the importance of competition." The whole Grant family rowed the boat with Dolph, escorting him to the island of Pinta, one of the most remote in the archipelago. As Pinta came into sight, and it was spectacular, I'd never been south before, let alone the Galapagos, a school of dolphins was leaping in the boat's bow wave. Peter Grant turned to me and said, "Well, Dolph, you know, there might only be a master's in this." Only a master's thesis, not a PhD. We had no idea what we'd find, in other words, Dolph explains with laughter in his voice. Grant was trying to say the idea might not be feasible, the plans might not work. The Grants taught Dolph how to set up mist nets, how to catch a bird and measure it. They stayed a week. Then it was, "Goodbye, we're off to Genovesa, see you in 5 months." Schluter and his field assistant were now the only human beings on the island. Like all the taller islands in the Galapagos, Pinta has an amazing slope. At the bottom, it is a desert of bare, black, pahoehoe lava and thorny scrub. Dry, hot sheets of bare rock. As you march up the slope, you walk into a cloud, and a green forest canopy begins to close over your head. The highlands are moist and cool. The ground is thick and soft underfoot, with deep forest litter. At the top is Elfin Forest, misty green, with moss-covered trees, lichens, orchids. As soon as he had learned to tell them apart, Dolph could see that the small beaks and the sharp beaks territories overlapped. Fuliginosa went up to the summit of the island, and Difficilis went not quite all the way to the bottom. "I saw that right at the beginning," he says. He had expected to find the two rivals living in separate zones of the island, bottom and top, as Lack had described, with territorial skirmishes all along the border. "That possibility was completely shot," Dolph says. All was quiet on the western, eastern, southern, and northern fronts. Fuliginosa and Difficilis were ignoring each other. "This is typical of fieldwork," he says now. "You plan and plan, and then you get there and realize you can't do it." In the next few months, he and his assistant set up study grids up and down the slope. They found, to their astonishment, that the finches, although they overlap in territory, overlap hardly at all in diet. On Pinta, Fuliginosa takes seeds out in the open, pecking on the hard, hot lava, mostly down by the shore. But Difficilis scratches with its long claws in the leaf litter, mostly up in the forest, kicking the leaves away, shoving pebbles aside, and snatching up spiders and snails, crickets and caterpillars with its beak. Fuliginosa eats hardly anything but seeds. Difficilis takes hardly any seeds. So if Darwin and Lack were right about the cause of the divergence, there was no way to tell by watching these birds. "There's very little trace of competition," Dolph says cheerfully. "It really is a ghost." Because he could not settle the competition question on that one island, he went on to another island and another. Over the next few years, he mapped Luck's patterns in ever finer detail from one end of the archipelago to the other. The masses of measurements that he and others collected were consistent with Lack's predictions, consistent to a remarkably detailed degree. Take Fortis, the medium-sized ground finch. Its equipment represents a trade-off between the best beak for small, soft seeds and the best beak for big, hard seeds. The bird evolves toward the best deal it can make, and on each island the best beak is determined partly by the presence of Fuliginosa, because small beaks in the dry season will lower the pile of small, soft seeds. A Fortis with a beak too small to crack a Tribulus will have to compete with Fuliginosa. But Fuliginosa are more efficient than Fortis can be, so the smaller Fortis will die younger than the bigger Fortis. In this way, competition with the small beaks drives up the average size of the medium beaks. On islands where it has been driven up in size by this competition with small beaks, it is much better with Tribulus, and it eats fewer small seeds. Fortis on Daphne has very little competition from Fuliginosa, and there Fortis throws down most of the Tribulus it picks up. On the other hand, Fortis on Pinta, Marchena, and Santiago, where there are many Fuliginosa, eat fewer small seeds but seldom meet a big seed they cannot crack. Meanwhile, where Fuliginosa is competing with Fortis, it tends to specialize in the smaller seeds because Fortis is so much more efficient with the big hard seeds of Tribulus and the prickly pear. But where it has an island all to itself, as on Los Hermanos, the beak of Fuliginosa is big and deep, and it can handle fairly big seeds. On Los Hermanos, its beak is almost identical to the beak of Fortis on Daphne. On the islands where Magnirostris is missing, the beak of Fortis is bigger than average. On the islands where Fuliginosa is missing, Fortis is smaller than average. It fills both its own niche and that of its missing rival. There are far too many pairs of species like the sharp beaks and the small beaks, or the small beaks and the medium beaks, or the medium and the large, that have divvied up the islands in this neat way between them, converging on the same beak where they live apart, but diverging where they are neighbors, making an infinity of finely calculated mutual adjustments for the patterns to be due to chance. Lack was essentially right. He was not right in every detail, Dolph says, but the mechanism was dead on. I've since concluded that he was a pretty bright fellow. He's my hero, actually. He had a disarming writing style, and he could make very forceful arguments. In fact, I think they should be called Laxfinches and not Darwin's. Darwin didn't see the significance of the birds. He thought there was just one species per island. He didn't even try to pull it together. He didn't do a bloody thing with them except collect them. That's why they're Laxfinches and not Darwin's. After a few years in the islands, Dolph arrived at a new way of visualizing the Darwinian pressures on Darwin's finches. Imagine a single population of birds on a desert island. As this population changes through time, generation after generation, it is perpetually moving toward the optimum design for that island. It is working toward its point of maximum fitness, toward what evolutionists sometimes call an adaptive peak. Picture that point of maximum fitness, the peak of optimal design, as the summit of a mountain. The slopes around the summit represent designs that are slightly inferior to the design right at the peak. The valleys far below represent designs that are fatally inferior to the design at the peak. A winner, a bird with the right beak, the right wings, the right tarsi, is on the peak. A loser is wandering down in the valley. If a bird is blown out to sea and lands on a desert island, it will not be perfectly adapted to its new home from the start. Its fitness will be somewhere down on the slope of the adaptive landscape. If it is very far down in the valley, it will die and its line will die out. But if it can hang on and breed, its descendants will move up and up, evolving and adapting until they reach the peak. Evolutionists have been thinking about adaptive landscapes for a long time. The idea was introduced by Sewell Wright, one of the last century's great neo-Darwinians, in 1932. The adaptive landscape is one of their favorite metaphors for evolutionary change, almost as popular as the tree of life itself. But Dolph was the first to see how revealing the idea could be when applied to Darwin's finches. Peter Grant had asked him to find a way of pulling together all of the group's work on beaks and seeds in one framework, to create an all-embracing mathematical model that would help the finch watchers understand what they were seeing. Dolph decided to draw their data in terms of adaptive landscapes, with the aid of computers. Dolph is one of the most sophisticated mathematicians in the Finch unit, along with Trevor Price, his old field mate and office mate, with and against whom he has honed his skills. In picturing the forces that lead to character divergence, the adaptive landscape makes a better metaphor than the tree of life. It permits a finer level of description. A population of finches splitting in two, the forking of a branch in the tree of life metaphor, can be imagined as setting off on a sort of lonely pilgrimage or mass migration across an adaptive landscape. Some birds leave one peak and migrate to another. First, there is just one species in the landscape, clustered around one peak. Then there are two, clustered around two neighboring peaks. In between, there lies a valley. It was in 1979 that Dolph realized how he could use this image of the adaptive landscape to test Darwin's principle of divergence with Darwin's finches. He realized that he and the other members of the Finch unit had amassed so many measurements that he could now draw a fairly realistic adaptive landscape for the Galapagos ground finches. The unit had measured all of the seeds these ground finches can eat, and many of the seeds they can't or won't eat. Dolph knew what kinds of seeds are found on each island, and in what season, and in what amounts. he entered that information into a computer. Dolph also knew how big a beak can crack how big a seed. The critical dimension here is beak depth. The deeper the beak, the bigger and harder the seed it can crack. He entered that relationship into the computer. Finally, he knew how many seeds it takes to keep a finch alive. He entered that relationship into the computer, too. Such and such a mass of seeds translates into such and such a mass of finches. Now, Dolph says in the tone of a geometrician who is trying to arrive at first principles, to use just a few lines and points and the minimum of rules, and from that generate a globe, a world, a universe. Suppose a single species of finch lands on a single Galapagos island. Suppose it meets no competition and it survives and multiplies. What size beak will it evolve? Dolph told the computer the range of beak sizes available to all of the ground finches on the islands, from the smallest to the largest ever measured. He also told the computer the range of seed sizes available on the islands, from the smallest to the largest, and how many of each size there are. Then he programmed the computer to calculate how many finches a hypothetical island could support, given finches with beaks of every possible depth, from the shallowest to the deepest finch beak on record anywhere in the world, at increments of a small fraction of a millimeter. He programmed the computer to make the calculation over and over. Dolph assumed that it would draw a peak corresponding to the best of all possible beaks, that is, the beak size that would produce the maximum number of finches on that idealized Galapagos island. The peak the computer drew would represent the best possible beak on the island. The valleys on either side of the peak would represent all the miscellaneous beak sizes that were relatively unfit. He set the computer going, and he was thrilled by what he saw. The computer did not draw a single peak. Instead, it drew three peaks with deep valleys between them. The computer had picked up something that is not obvious to the eye. Seeds in the Galapagos come in three types for a finch: easy, medium, and hard. Grass seeds are among the smallest and easiest. Tribulus seeds are among the largest and hardest. The seeds of the passion flower are among those in between. There is a continuous range, but on the whole, the seeds of the islands do cluster into these distinct groups. Accordingly, the computer had drawn three peaks for three beaks, one above each of the three piles of seeds. In effect, the computer had predicted three species of finches, each with a peak precisely the size to crunch the seeds in its pile. Three peaks meant there could be not one, but three highly adaptive beaks for ground finches on that idealized island. There was more than one good beak. A single founding species alighting in that adaptive landscape could diverge into three. Taking advantage of the finch unit's masses of data, Dolph programmed the computer to run a more realistic simulation. He asked it to calculate the beaks that should have evolved on a dozen islands of the Galapagos, given the seeds that are actually found on each island. With just three factors, beak size, seed size, and competition, the computer predicted correctly the divergent paths of evolution for the beaks of finches on every one of the islands. Once again, Darwin's finches are true to their destiny as paragons of Darwin's theory. They are the best case of a character displacement ever found. The struggle, Darwin writes in The Origin, will generally be more severe between species of the same genus when they come into competition with each other than between species of distinct genera. Yet in principle, Darwin's process of character displacement can occur even between living things spaced far apart on the evolutionary tree if they are thrown into competition. There can be competition between kingdoms, say between plants and animals, or plants and insects, or insects and bacteria. Two British evolutionists, Michael Hochberg and John Lawton, have made a calculation that they find both instructive and astonishing. Suppose there are 300,000 species of higher plants. Higher plants include ferns, conifers, flowering plants, essentially anything green that grows more than a few inches off the ground. And 300,000 species is a conservative estimate. If every one of those species is fed upon by just 10 species of insects, also a conservative estimate, and if each of those insects is the host for one infectious disease and five species of parasitoids, also conservative, then there is room for about 15 million different competitive interactions at this single busy intersection in the kingdoms of life. Almost no one has looked for divergence in action on this front, but Dolph Schluter has. He suspects that distant branches in the trees of life may be competing right now in the Galapagos. Some of Darwin's finches drink flower nectar, which finches do not do on continents. They can get away with it in the islands because they have little competition for it. Not many pollinating insects have crossed the Pacific and colonized the archipelago. Only one species of bee has made the journey so far, a large carpenter bee named for the naturalist who first discovered it, Xylocopa darwini. Darwin's bees have not made their way to the northernmost islands, but they are found in most of the southern islands. There they compete for flowers with the finches. The finches on the northern islands get most of their nectar from the little yellow flowers of Waltheria ovata. In the dry season, when food is hard to find, small beaks and some sharp beaks will drink nectar from Waltheria. The sharp beak inserts its whole long beak to probe the flower, while the small beak sticks in only its lower mandible. Both of these finches have gotten very good at the work. They can probe as many as 40 flowers a minute. On northern islands like Genovesa, where there are no bees, nectar makes up about 20% of these finches' diet. It is an important dietary supplement to the small seeds they spend their lives scrabbling for. But on southern islands, where there are bees, nectar makes up less than 5% of the bird's diet. Dolph has noticed that the nectar-drinking finches tend to be smaller than finches of the same species on islands where there are bees. For instance, the average wingspan of small beaks is almost 5 millimeters shorter on the islands of Pinta and Marchena, no bees, than on the islands of Fernandina, Santa Cruz, Santiago, Española, and Isabela, bees. Dolph once spent 2 weeks observing a spot on Marchena that was rich with yellow Waltheria flowers. He saw finches fighting to defend clumps of these flowers. Small beaks that owned a few clumps would defend them against other small beaks. Dolph netted and measured as many of these finches as he could. The average nectar drinker was significantly smaller and weighed about a gram less than the average teetotaler. That is, even on Marchena, only the finches that were cut out for flower feeding by their small size were drinking nectar. Apparently, then, on islands where there are no bees, selection pressure has reduced the size of two species of Darwin's finches, and these birds have squeezed into the bees' niche. On islands where bees have arrived, the birds have been forced back out of the niche. If so, this is a case of character displacement, not just between sibling species, but between a vertebrate and an invertebrate, which goes far beyond what Darwin imagined. We never see them fight over a flower, but there is no peace between the birds and the bees. Is character divergence universal and powerful, as Darwin thought, or is it rare and weak, as some evolutionists argue today? My own guess is, character divergence is likely to be quite common and important, says Peter Grant, but I think of rather small magnitude in terms of the quantity of the evolutionary shift. You mean, asks Rosemary, take two species that come together. Say they differ by 10%. They would need to be about 15% different to coexist without serious competition. There are two possible outcomes. One of the two may go extinct, or the two species may diverge until they are 15% different. That shift is not very great, only another 5%. I see, okay, says Rosemary. Now, if you agree with that, how easy would it be to see the evolution of that 5% shift? The answer is not at all easy. You'd need a lot of detail. Character divergence could be very common but simply not be known. In Peter's view, most of the divergence among Darwin's finches takes place when they are isolated, living on separate islands. Then, when they come together and share an island, competition drives their lines farther apart. This divergence is a simple consequence of the struggle for existence, just as Darwin imagined in his carriage. It pushes the finches one or two steps closer to the origin of species.